This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Thank you very much, Imran. Can I allow colleagues to pose questions? Any question? Dr. Subai, over to you. Cindy Hlongwane, can I give you a chance? I'll come back to you, Dr. Subai.
Thank you, Dr. Chandras. I just would like to ask one question. Imran, you touched on the fact consultation by the employer is very important before they can then implement the mandatory vaccination in the workplace. Now, the question becomes, in the absence of that consultation, can then, because in this instance, the consultation, I would assume, that cannot just only be relied on, for example, on the labor or trade unions. It would mean that, like as you said, for everybody there is a vested interest in this, and in this case, it's every staff member. So which means there has to be some platform where every person within the organization does get a platform where they can voice whether there's a level of consultation. Now, in the absence of that consultation, can an employer carry on and make a unilateral decision that says, I, as employer A, B, or C, will still implement mandatory vaccination in the workplace? Thank you.
In the absence of consultation, no, an employer may not roll out a policy. So to do so in the absence of consultation would be unlawful. And an employer that did that could then legitimately face objections from employees who are being obliged to be vaccinated. So that doesn't even get into the exemptions of medical or religious grounds. Simple failure to comply with the direction, because the direction says that there must be consultation. And in the absence of that, there can be an attack. The consultation is actually not very difficult. All an employer needs to do is to take this to its health and safety committee. If the health and safety committee, organized labor is already represented, have the consultation there. It doesn't require an agreement. It requires consultation. Once the consultation occurs at the health and safety committee, at that level, it can then roll out. So from a legal perspective, that's all that's required. And in your question, there were actually three sub-questions. The other was, if there's a trade union, does the employer have to consult with other employees? Well, the legal answer to that is no, because the direction only requires consultation with unions. It doesn't require consultation with groups of employees, only with the trade union. So that's the legal answer to it. But the reality is that the law is one aspect of it, and you've got to advise and you've got to deal with these things. And I made the point very sensitively. You can't adopt a very rigid approach to this and say, because the legal requirement is A, B, and C, this is all I need to do and I'm tick-boxing it. If you've got other interest groups, let's call it that, in a workplace that are not represented by a trade union, I certainly have advised clients in those instances to consult with those individuals, to understand what their concerns are. Because in the absence of a proper consultation with those individuals, you're going to end up having employees that are not going to want to take the vaccine. So it's better to have the consultation, and it's just better people management in dealing with people than simply imposing a vaccine on a very strict tick box approach. So I hope that answers the question.
All right, thank you very much, Imran. I think the more you clarify, you take away our grounds to resist. All right, thank you very much. Any questions, colleagues, if you have? Refill, over to you. And CBC Chris.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, colleagues, and good morning, Mr. Mohammed. Thank you so much for your presentation, and also thank you for the Bob Marley rhythm. I actually share the same I share the same sentiment. Mr. Mohammed, I just wanted you to just clarify a bit when you were saying, I think it was one slide when you talked about the health and safety direction of the DEL, that it should be strengthened so that the vaccination can become mandatory, where a risk assessment at the workplace requires this. Now, I just wanted to find out from you, maybe the technical part of it, what does this risk assessment consist of? Do you know of the nature of it? I mean, since you actually even said some 5 universities have actually embraced this, so do you perhaps know the nature of this risk assessment? Thank you so much.
The risk, Chris, thanks. But I think we'll perhaps pick up the questions as they come along. The risk assessment has actually been legislated in inverted commas, because none of this is legislated to Parliament. Because of this national state of disaster, and here's me being a lawyer, the laws are not being passed through Parliament at the moment. The laws are being passed, being determined through directives issued under the National State of Disaster Act by particular ministers. So this question of a risk assessment was issued in terms of a directive last year already by the Minister of Labour. So employers at the time of, once we'd come out of the initial hard lockdown, and when we say the hard lockdown was the first bit of it, for employers to allow employees to return to the work, to return to the workplace, it needed to conduct what was then called a risk assessment. So risk assessments have been with us for quite some time already. That risk assessment needs to be updated by the employer and submitted to the DEL within particular periods. Whether what employers do it or not is a different compliance issue, but it already exists. And what an employer needs to do is update those risk assessments, then determine, having regard to the particulars of my workplace, do I need a mandatory vaccine policy in order to avoid transmission of COVID within that workplace? And that's what that risk assessment would look like. So effectively, what an employer looks for is, over the period, how many employees have contracted COVID, how many employees contracted COVID potentially in the workplace, how many potential transmissions of COVID had there been in the workplace, what's the operational risk, should all employees come back without social distancing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That determines your risk assessment. And so that needs, it's already in existence. It needs to be updated. It needs to be considered in the formulation before the formulation of a policy.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mohammed. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
With pleasure.
All right, thank you very much. I managed to get hold of Reshma. Reshma is available now, maybe before Chris. Can I allow you, Reshma, to go ahead?
Thank you, Becca. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can loud and clear.
Fantastic. Mr. Mohammed, my question is around the students. I like the clarity you provided for employees, but my concern here is around students. So the way I understood it is that there are basically two grounds on which you can refuse. I think it was religious grounds and the body integrity. So say a student, I just want to give a scenario, and if you could reflect on what the other universities are doing in this regard. So if a student says they don't want to be vaccinated, and they have NSFAS funding, can we as a university now deny them access to accommodation? Because remember, the student experience at a university is not simply just accessing campus facilities, but it could be on-campus residence, off-campus residence. So I'd like to know the relationship between a student that says no, and the policy says, if you don't have a vaccine, you can't come to campus. But this student has NSFAS funding. The university is being paid. What rights does the student have? They paid for their fees and accommodation. Can we still go ahead as a university and deny them access to facilities that might not necessarily be on campus?
The focus on my presentation in relation to employers is because, with regards to employers, there's better clarity in law. So you'll remember I said that prior to June, it was rather difficult for us to advise, because we were advising in the abstract to a large extent, to say, look, our views of the law is A, B, and C. I must say that we were actually quite relieved when this direction was issued, because it kind of confirmed the sort of advice that we were given to clients in any event prior to the direction being issued. So the direction gives clarity in relation to workplaces. To a large extent, these principles are going to find application in a public in a public space such as the university as well. So the student funding from NSFAS, and I haven't seen it, but I can see no reason why it would not provide in its funding arrangement with a student to say, one of the requirements in order to gain access to NSFAS funding is going to be that you are vaccinated. So in the absence of you being vaccinated, you're not going to get funding. So forget a 75% pass rate, which is what the minister was saying you should be achieving, and something that should have happened 30 years ago already. But you should be passing 75% of your courses. What we're also going to require in terms of our arrangement with you is that you must be vaccinated. That would be the easiest place in order to do it. But I don't know what NSFAS is doing in relation to that, but that's one avenue. To get right into the nuts and bolts of your question, would you be able to exclude that student who's actually no different to an individually funded or privately funded or self-funded student? Because in reality, all students have to pay. Right? And would you then be able to exclude those students from campus accommodation and from classes? Yes, you would. And why? Because the overriding factor is going to be we're in a pandemic. The science shows that you require a vaccine. And I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to debate efficacies and the like. But wherever you read it, the suggestions are, or at least this, we've been told that the science says you've got to be vaccinated. Once that becomes the starting point of the argument, then you can only find yourself within an exception. An exception is, I cannot be vaccinated because I've got a medical objection. I've got a medical reason. And what's the medical reason? The medical reason is not a side effect. It's not that I fear I may have a side effect. It's got to be from a doctor that says, this particular individual cannot be vaccinated because of whatever reason.
They're at risk.
That's exactly it. So that's your bodily argument in terms of the Constitution. So that's only a specific category of people. The other is religious objections. I can tell you, mainstream religious organizations have already pinned their colors to the mast. Most mainstream religious denominations have taken the view that the vaccine is not irreligious. So you then need to come along and you've got to say, on some religious ground, I'm objecting. And we've got enough law on what constitutes a justifiable religious belief and sincerity, et cetera, but you've got to fall into that. So unless your student can come along within those two groups, they can be excluded from res and they can be excluded from your classes.
Okay. Thank you for that clarity. Really, I really appreciate it.
It's the harsh reality of how this thing is going to play out.
Sorry, I have one follow-up question. You mentioned consultations with the occupational health and safety, but that covers employees. What about consultations with students? How would that work?
Well, currently there's no provision in the law that deals with universities on this specifically, but it only makes sense. And in my experience, you certainly have consultation with your SRC, obviously. And any other elected university student associations. And I can tell you without disclosing names, even student political organizations are being consulted. Not because you want to elevate anybody to a particular pedestal, even house committees at different races are being consulted, because the principle is consult as widely as possible and try and get buy-in. And whilst consultations are not always easy, it's got to be done. Because otherwise, to roll out this a mandatory policy just becomes impossible.
Thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I want to kill this one, colleagues. We're supposed to move to the second presentation, but I gave CBC a chance before. Can you be the last one, CBC?
Yes, thank you very much. Just to take this out of the education environment, I just want to mention to the colleagues that sometimes the companies are not really making it mandatory to vaccinate because it's something they want to. But it becomes very difficult to do business with other companies if your employees are not vaccinated. I do quite a lot of marketing for my company. I cannot visit some of these companies and some of our suppliers because they make it mandatory for anyone who's visiting their premises to be vaccinated. So this is not just, you know, an issue that is linked to your company alone, but for you to do business with other companies, you have to comply with this. Thank you.
Yeah, that's 100% nail on the head. So it's happening all over where contractors or suppliers to particular companies cannot access the company's premises if the supplier or contractor is not vaccinated. So that's happening as well. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Imran. I think now I am a learned person.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.